Welcome to the C-Level Conversations podcast. Do you want to learn how leaders make their hardest decisions and why? Then you're in the right place. Join us for inspirational and educational interviews with dynamic senior executives across all industry sectors, sharing real-life lessons and practical tips to elevate your career as a leader. And now, here is your host, Amrutha Murali.
Gender stereotypes create a no-win situation for women leaders. Today's episode is on the double-bind dilemma faced by women: extreme perceptions where they are seen as too hard or too soft, but never just right. A high competency threshold where women are required to meet higher standards than men for lower rewards. And the competent but disliked dilemma, where women may be seen as competent or personable, but never both. Today we talk about double bind that competent women face in a man's world, and does the think leader, think male mindset create an invisible barrier for women? I have with me today Sandy Chakravarti, an accomplished C-level leader. Sandy is a strategic and innovative leader with an executive career of more than 25 years, spanning across Australian and international blue chip organizations. Sandy currently serves as the chair of the Finance Audit Investment and Risk Committee at the Southern Metropolitan Cemeteries Trust, Queen Victoria Market. Sandy's previous board and committee chair experience also includes Australian Red Cross Blood Services Lifeblood, International Women's Development Agency, Link Community Transport, Eating Disorders Victoria, and the National Association for Women in Operations. Welcome, Sandy. Very happy to have you as my guest.
Thank you, Amrutha, for your kind introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here with you today.
You've had such a successful career and had several senior leadership roles. Has this always been your ambition and interest?
My drive for operational excellence, you know, has chartered my career. My background in finance has given me the discipline and due diligence to achieve this excellence. At a leadership level, my authenticity, performance focus, empathy and resilience has meant that I've added value to organizations. And that's, I guess, been my career trajectory. I have extensive senior leadership experience across corporate and commercial functions, where I've driven strategic, commercial and transformational initiatives. I'm excited by change and transformation. At the same time, as you'll see, I do have a board career too, and therefore governance and steering organization towards a growth trajectory and excellence in navigating organizations through crisis, such as the recent pandemic, are also my passions. So I've got a fair few passions, as you can see. But having said that, this all sounds really wonderful, but my ambition as a child was quite different to this. Yeah, it was not focused on having a career. Like every average girl, little girl at a young age, I always dreamt of a Prince Charming and being a beautiful bride and having a large family. In addition, I was a good classical dancer and wanted to pursue a career in dancing. But I guess life intervenes, and you can see sometimes, you know, it's a question of managing your dreams in such a way to get to a different outcome, but a happy outcome nevertheless.
And dancing, what sort of dancing were you interested in?
I was interested in classical Indian dancing, which is Bharatanatyam, which is from the south of India. And yeah, I was quite good at it, if I might say so myself. But it's one of those, unfulfilled dreams of mine, I guess.
Lovely. Now, for those listeners who don't know you, tell us about your journey and what shaped you as the leader you are today.
What has impacted that journey? It has been several life events, I think, or maybe a couple of key life events. My father passed away when I was 7 years old, and this was a major turning point in my life and also, I guess, my family's life. I knew we had to excel in everything we do because in order to be, you know, successful in life, we had to be good at what we do. And therefore, you know, the focus of my energies was on performance at school, you know, being top at school, and also, you know, being the best at what we do. So, like, for example, I mentioned my dancing. I was really good at dancing. So whatever endeavors we picked up, it was the performance focus that was built in, and the energy that's been driven into it. Yeah. Having dealt with tragedy so early in the life also meant that I could relate to people at a human level. And empathy then developed in me right from a very early age. So seeing both not only a performance focus, but also empathy at the same time, you know, the balance of the brain and the heart, you know, has developed from me right from the beginning. Yeah. So the other key life event was migrating to Australia. It gave me, I guess, it opened my eyes to the future possibilities and the opportunities which India didn't offer to us at that time. And it gave me the economic freedom to pursue my career choices and my life choices, which I've done so far.
I'm sorry to hear about your father passing away at such a young age. It's truly inspiring to see how you overcome such a difficult loss and achieved success in your career. And your determination and hard work is surely incredible, commendable. Let's dive into today's topic to discuss the double bind that women face at workplace. So would you agree that double bind is for real? Could you share some of your experiences with us today?
The societal expectations actually drive the fact that there does exist a double bind. And what I mean by societal expectations is that people expect men to, you know, be strong, powerful leaders, whereas women are seen as soft, homemakers, loving, you know, having that nurturing kind of style. So when you put that style into a corporate leadership environment, there seems to be a dissonance around understanding how this style of working would, you know, exist and manage in a corporate environment. And what that has meant is women then have to tread a tightrope in establishing their own leadership style and space. Yeah. The basic tenets of a good leader, such as speaking up, paving the way, being seen to be vulnerable, being excellent at what you all do, can be construed in a woman, especially, as being shrill, bitchy, and climbing over others' shoulders, a lack of compassion, or even being too emotional at times. Yeah.
Yes.
So I'll give you a couple of examples, I think, Amrita. Carly Fiorina, who we all know and, you know, has been famous in terms of, I guess, her rise and fall has been quite effectively depicted in business environments. She was the former CEO of HP, and she depicted this in this particular way. She said, and I quote, "In the chat rooms around Silicon Valley, from time to time, I've arrived until after a long time I left HP. I was routinely referred to as either being a bimbo or a bitch, too soft or too hard, and also presumptuous at times." And closer to home, if you can say, to give you another example, let's take the example of Julia Gillard, Australia's first female prime minister. You know, I guess, you know, Amrita, she's no stranger to sexism.
Yes.
While occupying the nation's top political job, right? You'll probably all remember, and this completely stumps me, right? I never fail to understand, in relation to the carbon tax issue and what is the so-called debacle around the carbon tax when she tried to introduce that. And, you know, there was the Ditch the Bitch campaign. And Tony Abbott was famous to, you know, have promoted and standing in front of those placards condoning the Ditch the Bitch campaign. And what did it do to Julia Gillard's career? It just completely decimated her career. But what has it done to Tony Abbott's career? He's going from strength to strength. So
yes.
it just shows you that the double bind is for real, right?
Now, Sandy, you've worked in some male-dominated industries at board level. Can you take us through with some examples of this unconscious bias that actually played out at the workplaces at a senior level? We've just spoken about some examples, but some personal examples that come to mind?
Yeah, absolutely. And if I might, look, as I said, the double bind does exist, but
yes.
I guess I'd like to introduce another, I guess, dimension to it, in the sense, being a woman of color. And that actually makes it a triple bind, if I might say. Women are expected, you know, to be in, what my experience has been is that as long as women are in traditionally supportive roles, in sync with societal expectations, and especially for women from the Indian subcontinent, are seen and perceived and accepted as being great at supportive roles, such as in finance, IT. But what I've seen is that as long as I was at that supportive role in finance, because finance is my background, it was fine. I was seen as a great performer, as a great contributor, as an individual contributor, as a great team builder. But the moment you cross that ceiling over to the C-suite or the boardroom, the same behaviors which got you the success and performance and promotions and moving up the ladder, we step into the realm of bitchiness, aggression, and such descriptors. Yeah, the triple bind, I think, occurs more so for women of color, as it is simply unacceptable for people to accept authority and power from a woman of color. And this, I think, applies both to women and men, don't you think?
Yes, I agree. This adds another dimension to the conversation on the double bind.
Yeah. And I think societal expectations, which I mentioned before, I guess, based on the foundations of, I guess, a white culture, and adding the dimension of the, you know, people of color, or even, I would actually expand it to say people of color, not necessarily women of color, but women of color, I think, face it much more than people of color, which includes the men. And it's important that we recognize that there is a triple bind for women of color. Yeah.
Yes. And I agree with you. You know, see, you spoke about it's accepted and appreciated as long as you're in a supportive role. And
yes,
that goes that's very true. And I think once you go across to the senior C-suite and board level, and that's when these dynamics start playing out.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. Now on patriarchy. And I know you love talking about patriarchy.
Don't set me off, Amrita, about the patriarchy.
Okay, most women leaders understand how to play the game. Should we smash the patriarchy by simply refusing to play along? Or is there somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, look, I think obviously my preference is, of course, to smash the patriarchy. But something that has been around for generations, you know, the patriarchy has ruled. So it's not something we can topple, you know, in one generation, even as we have seen. I think the women's movement has started for a, you know, few generations, but we still haven't managed to break through the patriarchy or smash it in any way. We have probably made huge inroads. Yeah.
Yes.
So in the sense that what I feel is that the way to smash the patriarchy is to bring the consciousness of people of that there is a different leadership style. That is, the only leadership style is not a male leadership style. Leadership styles can be different. Yeah. It is time for us to redefine what it means to be a leader. Though all of us women did it, yeah, wearing power suits, conforming to the stereotype, we tried at first, you know, becoming male. I've done it all the time, you know, worn my power suits, walked into boardrooms and meeting rooms with the power suits. But, you know, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So smashing the patriarchy, we have to define and redefine a new leadership style, not necessarily for women or for men, but that defining by saying that people have different leadership styles and you cannot classify it as being a male or a female style. Yeah. Good leaders are those that possess a toolkit of styles that suit at different stages of an organization's life cycle and one's individual career. And that's what I've tried to abide by in my journey. Yeah. And obviously the answer is, you know, to smash the patriarchy is to come up with these different styles and getting societal expectations moving towards that, to say there is no use typecasting leadership. Leadership is as varied as there are a number of people.
So for our listeners today, you know, aspiring women leaders and leaders who are facing this double bind in their workplaces, any suggestions there as to how they could handle this this challenge?
Yeah, look, I think it's very important that women are conscious that they need to deal with this consciously. Yeah, it's no use being reactive to, facing the double bind or even the triple bind. Yeah, female leaders who display masculine qualities like assertiveness, forcefulness, and ambition, as you know, are called bitchy. Yeah, unfeminine, aggressive. So how do we deal it, you know, in a way is what I've done is through adaptive leadership styles. Yeah. Adapting to the situation at hand so that you're not always consistently seen. You don't be aggressive at all times. Yeah. Or seen as aggressive at all times. For instance, while running project team meetings, you know, I'm disciplined, authoritative, stickler to timelines and very outcome focused. Yeah. But say, for example, I'm part of a team that's drafting a people-oriented policy, or we are dealing with individuals. I display my empathy, care, and give importance to values and culture of the organization and of the people. Yeah. So then, you know, you're seen as both being authoritative as and directive as and assertive when the time is required, but you can also step into the realm of being empathetic. So then you're not branded as being assertive all the time. The other one is to have allies. Yeah. I believe very strongly in building relationships and trust. And my focus has been all the time to build that relationship and trust so that in case it comes to a situation where you have to wield your authority, have to be assertive, there's a lens that's put on it, which is a bit more, I guess, accepting than if you didn't have that allyship, if I might call it that. So I've used female mentors who have gone through that journey themselves and I can learn from them and who are ready to share their experiences with me. That's very powerful because then you're not reinventing the wheel. You learn from other people's experiences rather than your own. So you avoid the mistakes right up front. Yeah. And the male mentors and champions who are my allies are valuable when you need them, especially when you want to knock on doors that otherwise wouldn't have opened for you, and to coach you in seeing things from a male perspective. So, you know, you can develop strategies in advance to deal with male attitudes and their ways of working. So it's about yes. strategizing around all of that.
That's very valuable. You know, I think women also need to know how men think.
Correct. And the other couple of things I think is patience and perseverance, sticking to my authentic style of leadership, balancing of the brain and the heart, as I mentioned before, and keeping to my values. It's always helped, you know, in the long run. You know, it's the long game you're playing there, not the short one, because perseverance and patience does take time. Initially, you'll probably get a lot of flack in the sense that people will not understand potentially the long game you're playing, but you've got to keep at it. So for example, I remember a program of work that was designed in an organization I have been in the past. I knew it was headed towards, it was not going to achieve the outcomes that it was supposed to achieve. And I knew this truly in the deep of my, in my heart and in my gut that it was not going to work. I tried to convey that message to all the decision makers concerned, but it wasn't accepted. But I kept chipping away at it. And the end, unfortunately, what I felt in my gut came to fruition. In the end, it was accepted that what I put forward as the outcome and as the way of getting to that outcome was actually the right way to do it. And we went ahead and did it the way that I had suggested in the beginning. Yeah. Now, the feedback that I got during that process was that I was seen as intimidating, counter to the team's view. But I sometimes think, you know, would you have got the same feedback if I was a man? Well, you know, it's an interesting question, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And that's what we're discussing today about how men and female leaders would go about and do the same, style of leadership, but would be perceived differently because you're female.
Yeah. And one of the lessons I got out of this exercise is how to reframe your position. Yeah. Maybe the learning I had was the reason why perhaps I wasn't listened to, or my opinion and my position that I was stating wasn't listened to. I should have been more strategic in my thinking and decided, maybe I need to reframe that, because if one strategy doesn't work, you've got to look at another strategy, right? So I should have reframed my position and come across more confidently. And maybe I didn't come across more confidently. And confidence is another thing, I guess, another aspect of leadership, which, you know, quite understated and undermined by especially women. So I've seen a lot of women who have the right thing to say, have the technical and the leadership abilities to go a long way. But sometimes due to the, I guess, the pressures around them and being in a male-dominated world, lack the confidence to put that position and understanding the and having the maturity to reframe it if required. So I think reframing your position with confidence is quite important.
No, I fully agree with you. And I think there's some role to for the women to take on board as well. I think the confidence that we can put ourselves forward with will make a big difference. And I find from my own experience when you know, we go out with confidence, men respect you more. So there's that element to it as well. Now, you did mention mentoring is a key contributor. Do you mentor people as well?
Yes, I have mentored, especially people, immigrants. For example, I did a course of leadership at Leadership Victoria. And as part of that, I was in their mentorship program. And I've done a lot of mentorship to young women, especially who have come from like Africa, you know, Asian countries, and in need of a role model from, I guess, from familiar leaders who relate, who they can relate to from their own cultures, from their own color. I think, I've done a lot of mentorship around that. Yeah.
That ties back into what you were saying about the third bind, if you're the way you put it across, around color and people who are of color moving to a new country and who face different challenges.
And yeah, you can see that in the board directorships that I hold, that, you know, I've over 10 years of experience in not-for-profit boards. And that's my way of giving back to the community, I guess.
Fabulous. Now, we touched on this earlier on, you know, where we were talking about a stereotype, you know, of a male leader who takes charge by being assertive, strong, and decisive. But when women take charge, how they're expected to be soft, nurturing, communicative, and viewed as being emotional. So for managers listening today, you know, what are your strategies that what you think can be used in avoiding or falling into this trap of unconscious bias?
One of the key things is unconscious bias is called unconscious for a reason, because it is unconscious, right? And therefore, it's calling out that bias. You'll be amazed at the number of times I've actually had to call out this unconscious bias. And it's really true. The men that I've spoken to had no idea they had that bias in place. Men who actually pride themselves as being promoters of the women's cause and promoting women to, you know, to C-suite jobs, to the boardrooms, they definitely display the unconscious bias. And, you know, it's just amazing how many times you have to call it out. Now, in one of the ways, the strategies I've learned is, I've talked about confidence. It's with confidence, dignity, and I guess sensitivity that I've tried to call this bias out. In the past, I never did call the bias out. I was too, I guess, meek, if I can call it that, to call the bias out. But it's important we call it out when it happens.
I think that's a very important point you make, calling it out and having the confidence to call it out.
Yes. You know, for years, I've silently borne the unconscious bias, but I've reached a point, I guess, and the confidence comes from, you know, I guess, years of experience and maturity that you develop. It's very difficult for a young, you know, I guess, 25-year-old female of color, even if it's not of color, a young female, when she picks up the unconscious bias to talk to someone, you know, of a leadership position in their 40s, it's really hard to pick that up and call it out, yeah? But, you know, we've got to do it. And it's women like us who have to call it out to help those young women who are in their 20s starting on their career, yeah?
Yes, and then give them the confidence that they can succeed and they can go ahead with that. I fully agree with you. They need to find their voice.
They need to find their voice. Absolutely right. And I think at the same time, It's also being helping women. And I found a lot of women, especially the women who've come through previously to leadership positions. There's, you know, this, I guess, aura around those women. And those women tend not to help other women. And I think calling out women helping women is also another key way to actually break this unconscious bias. Because as long more and more women can be seen as being in leadership positions, breaking down the barriers, helping other women will help to break through the barrier of the unconscious bias that men also start perceiving women more and more as equal partners. Yeah. I think that's when you can break down the barriers too. And being seen, as I've said, as a visible champion, mentor to other women, all of that, promoting accomplishments of other women. You know, I guess, so for example, if you look at LinkedIn, use that as a platform to promote women who work with you, work for you, or, you know in your networks who have done incredible pieces of work, promote all of that. Make sure you're there as a visible champion in destroying that unconscious bias. Yeah.
Yeah, that's such an important point you make. I think if women need to acknowledge, support, promote other women and help them. So, Sandy, you're now seeking board appointments in ASX-listed companies. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. I've had over 10 years' experience in not-for-profit boards. I'm the chair of Finance, Audit, Investment and Risk Committees at the Southern Metropolitan Symmetries Trust, at the Queen Victoria Market. And my previous experiences include Austrian Red Cross Blood Service, which is now called the Lifeblood, the International Women's Development Agency, amongst others. Yeah. Now, my executive career spanned both the commercial and not-for-profit and public sector organizations. And I bring that, I guess, great combination and experiences from quite a few sectors, all the three sectors, if I might say so. I have the unique ability to leverage and a strong mix of all my national, international, and sectoral experiences. And I have a lot of, I guess, critical thinking is one of my great assets, which is very effective when you've got such deep and wide experiences. It helps in effective decision making very well across change and transformation, as I've mentioned before. I'm passionate about governance, risk, and strategy. And I think all of that is a very good package for being a board member or chair of audit and risk committees. I have a lot of global exposure. As you see, I've worked in Australia, Asia Pacific, China, India, USA, and Europe. I am a strong advocate of financial sustainability and commercialization avenues for future-proofing organizations through transformations. I've done a lot of transformations across all of the organizations I've worked in, fairly attuned to ESG and diversity, and obviously passionate about the diversity agenda. Yes. Yeah, and I think we have talked a little bit of the leadership style. So all of this now, I think, puts me in a great position to now step into the ASX realm.
Awesome. And where can people connect with you if they wanted to continue this conversation?
LinkedIn is obviously the premier platform for connections, and you know, you can reach me on LinkedIn at Sandy Chakravarti.
Thank you so much for your time and insights, Sandy. I'm sure our listeners would have found it of great value.
Thank you, Amrita. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my thoughts on leadership and the double bind, two of my favorite topics. I trust it's of value to all your listeners, and open to any more conversations, mentorship and governance roles. In case listeners want to reach out to me, very happy to have a discussion and network with them.
Head to our website, jobfits.com.au. That's jobfits.com.au. And I'll have all the links to connect with Sandy in the show notes.